This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Astrophysics for People in a Hurry by Neil deGrasse Tyson. This book is read by Neil deGrasse Tyson.
For all those who are too busy to read fat books, yet nonetheless seek a conduit to the cosmos. Preface. In recent years, no more than a week goes by without news of a cosmic discovery worthy of banner headlines. While media gatekeepers may have developed an interest in the universe, this rise in coverage likely comes from a genuine increase in the public's appetite for science. Evidence for this abounds, from hit television shows inspired or informed by science, to the success of science fiction films starring marquee actors and brought to the screen by celebrated producers and directors. And lately, theatrical release biopics featuring important scientists have become a genre unto itself. There's also widespread interest around the world in science festivals, science fiction conventions, and science documentaries for television. The highest-grossing film of all time is by a famous director who set his story on a planet orbiting a distant star. And it features a famous actress who plays an astrobiologist. While most branches of science have ascended in this era, the field of astrophysics persistently rises to the top. I think I know why. At one time or another, every one of us has looked up at the night sky and wondered, what does it all mean? How does it all work? And what is my place in the universe? If you're too busy to absorb the cosmos via classes, textbooks, or documentaries, and you nonetheless seek a brief but meaningful introduction to the field, I offer you Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. In this slim volume, you will earn a foundational fluency in all the major ideas and discoveries that drive our modern understanding of the universe. If I've succeeded, you'll be culturally conversant in my field of expertise, and you just may be hungry for more. The universe is under no obligation to make sense to you. Chapter 1. The Greatest Story Ever Told. The world has persisted many a long year, having once been set going into the appropriate motions. From these, everything else follows. Lucretius, 50 BC. In the beginning, nearly 14 billion years ago, all the space and all the matter and all the energy of the known universe was contained in a volume less than 1/1,000,000,000th the size of the period that ends this sentence. Conditions were so hot, the basic forces of nature that collectively describe the universe were unified. Though still unknown how it came into existence, this sub-pinpoint-sized cosmos could only expand rapidly in what today we call the Big Bang. Einstein's general theory of relativity, put forth in 1916, gives us our modern understanding of gravity, in which the presence of matter and energy curves the fabric of space and time surrounding it. In the 1920s, quantum mechanics would be discovered, providing our modern account of all that is small, molecules, atoms, and subatomic particles. But these two understandings of nature are formally incompatible with one another, which set physicists off on a race to blend the theory of the small with the theory of the large, into a single coherent theory of quantum gravity. Although we haven't yet reached the finish line, we know exactly where the high hurdles are. One of them is during the Planck era of the early universe. That's the interval of time from t equals zero up to t equals 10 to the minus 43 seconds. 1/10,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, 10^-35 meters, 100 billion trillion trillionths of a meter across. The German physicist Max Planck, after whom these unimaginably small quantities are named, introduced the idea of quantized energy in 1900 and is generally credited as the father of quantum mechanics. The clash between gravity and quantum mechanics poses no practical problem for the contemporary universe. Astrophysicists apply the tenets and tools of general relativity and quantum mechanics to very different classes of problems. But in the beginning, during the Planck era, The large was small, and we suspect there must have been a kind of shotgun wedding between the two. Alas, the vows exchanged during that ceremony continue to elude us, and so no known laws of physics describe with any confidence the behavior of the universe over that time. We nonetheless expect that by the end of the Planck era, gravity wriggled loose from the other still unified forces of nature, achieving an independent identity nicely described by our current theories. As the universe aged through 10 to the minus 35 seconds, it continued to expand, diluting all concentrations of energy, and what remained of the unified forces split into the electroweak and the strong nuclear forces. Later still, the electroweak force split into the electromagnetic and the weak nuclear forces, laying bare the four distinct forces we have come to know and love. With the weak force controlling radioactive decay, the strong force binding the atomic nucleus, the electromagnetic force binding molecules, and gravity binding bulk matter. A trillionth of a second has passed since the beginning. All the while, the interplay of matter in the form of subatomic particles and energy in the form of photons, massless vessels of light energy that are as much waves as they are particles, was incessant. The universe was hot enough for these photons to spontaneously convert their energy into matter-antimatter particle pairs, which immediately thereafter annihilate, returning their energy back to photons. Yes, antimatter is real, and we discovered it, not science fiction writers. These transmogrifications are entirely prescribed by Einstein's most famous equation, E equals mc squared, which is a two-way recipe for how much matter your energy is worth and how much energy your matter is worth. The c squared is the speed of light squared, a huge number which, when multiplied by the mass, reminds us how much energy you actually get in this exercise. Shortly before, during, and after the strong and electroweak forces parted company, the universe was a seething soup of quarks, leptons, and their antimatter siblings, along with bosons, the particles that enable their interactions. None of these particle families is thought to be divisible into anything smaller or more basic, though each comes in several varieties. The ordinary photon is a member of the boson family. The leptons most familiar to the non-physicist are the electron and perhaps the neutrino. And the most familiar quarks are... well, there are no familiar quarks. Each of their six subspecies has been assigned an abstract name that serves no real philological, philosophical, or pedagogical purpose, except to distinguish it from others. Up and down, strange and charmed, and top and bottom. Bosons, by the way, are named for the Indian scientist Satyendra Nath Bose. The word lepton derives from the Greek leptos, meaning light or small. Quark, however, has a literary and far more imaginative origin. The physicist Murray Gell-Mann, who in 1964 proposed the existence of quarks as the internal constituents of neutrons and protons, and who, at the time, thought the quark family had only three members, drew the name from a characteristically elusive line in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. Three quarks for Muster Mark. One thing quarks do have going for them: all their names are simple. Something chemists, biologists, and especially geologists seem incapable of achieving when naming their own stuff. Quarks are quirky beasts. Unlike protons, each with an electric charge of plus one, and electrons with a charge of minus one, quarks have fractional charges that come in thirds. And you'll never catch a quark all by itself. It will always be clutching other quarks nearby. In fact, the force that keeps two or more of them together actually grows stronger the more you separate them, as if they were attached by some sort of subnuclear rubber band. Separate the quarks enough, the rubber band snaps, and the stored energy summons E equals mc squared to create a new quark at each end, leaving you back where you started. During the quark-lepton era, the universe was dense enough for the average separation between unattached quarks to rival the separation between attached quarks. Under those conditions, allegiance between adjacent quarks could not be unambiguously established, and they moved freely among themselves, in spite of being collectively bound to one another. The discovery of this state of matter, a kind of quark cauldron, was reported for the first time in 2002 by a team of physicists at the Brookhaven National Laboratories, Long Island, New York. Strong theoretical evidence suggests that an episode in the very early universe, perhaps during one of the force splits, endowed the universe with a remarkable asymmetry, in which particles of matter barely outnumbered particles of antimatter, by about 1 billion in 1 to 1 billion. That small difference in population would hardly get noticed by anybody amid the continuous creation, annihilation, and recreation of quarks and antiquarks, electrons and anti-electrons, better known as positrons, and neutrinos and antineutrinos. The odd man out had oodles of opportunity to find somebody to annihilate with, and so did everybody else. But not for much longer. As the cosmos continued to expand and cool, growing larger than the size of our solar system, the temperature dropped rapidly below 1 trillion degrees Kelvin. 1/1 millionth of a second has passed since the beginning. This tepid universe was no longer hot enough or dense enough to cook quarks, and so they all grabbed dance partners, creating a permanent new family of heavy particles called hadrons, from the Greek hadros, meaning thick. That quark-to-hadron transition soon resulted in the emergence of protons and neutrons, as well as other less familiar heavy particles, all composed of various combinations of quark species. In Switzerland, back on Earth, the European Particle Physics Collaboration, CERN, uses a large accelerator to collide beams of hadrons in an attempt to recreate these very conditions. This largest machine in the world is sensibly called the Large Hadron Collider. The slight matter-antimatter asymmetry afflicting the quark-lepton soup now passed to the hadrons, but with extraordinary consequences. As the universe continued to cool, the amount of energy available for the spontaneous creation of basic particles dropped. During the hadron era, ambient photons could no longer invoke E equals mc squared to manufacture quark-antiquark pairs. Not only that, the photons that emerged from all the remaining annihilations lost energy to the ever-expanding universe, dropping below the threshold required to create hadron-antihadron pairs. For every 1 billion annihilations, leaving 1 billion photons in their wake, a single hadron survived. Those loners would get to have all the fun, serving as the ultimate source of matter to create galaxies, stars, planets, and petunias. Without the 1 billion and 1 to 1 billion imbalance between matter and antimatter, all mass in the universe would have self-annihilated, leaving a cosmos made of photons and nothing else. The ultimate let there be light scenario. By now, 1 second of time has passed. The universe has grown to a few light years across, about the distance from the sun to its closest neighboring stars. At 1 billion degrees, it's still plenty hot and still able to cook electrons, which, along with their positron counterparts, continue to pop in and out of existence. But in the ever-expanding, ever-cooling universe, their days, seconds really, are numbered. What was true for quarks and true for hadrons had become true for electrons. Eventually, only 1 electron in 1 billion survives. The rest annihilate with positrons, their antimatter sidekicks, in a sea of photons. Right about now, 1 electron for every proton has been frozen into existence. As the cosmos continues to cool, dropping below 1 billion degrees, protons fuse with other protons as well as with neutrons, forming atomic nuclei and hatching a universe in which 90% of these nuclei are hydrogen and 10% are helium, along with trace amounts of deuterium, heavy hydrogen, tritium, even heavier hydrogen, and lithium. 2 minutes have now passed since the beginning. For another 380,000 years, not much will happen to our particle soup. Throughout these millennia, the temperature remains hot enough for electrons to roam free among the photons, batting them to and fro as they interact with one another. But this freedom comes to an abrupt end When the temperature of the universe falls below 3,000 degrees Kelvin, about half the temperature of the sun's surface, and all the free electrons combine with nuclei, the marriage leaves behind a ubiquitous bath of visible light, forever imprinting the sky with a record of where all the matter was in that moment, and completing the formation of particles and atoms in the primordial universe. For the first billion years, the universe continued to expand and cool as matter gravitated into the massive concentrations we call galaxies. Nearly 100 billion of them formed, each containing hundreds of billions of stars that undergo thermonuclear fusion in their cores. Those stars, with more than about 10 times the mass of the sun, achieve sufficient pressure and temperature in their cores to manufacture dozens of elements heavier than hydrogen, including those that compose planets and whatever life may thrive upon them. These elements would be stunningly useless were they to remain where they formed, but high-mass stars fortuitously explode, scattering their chemically enriched guts throughout the galaxy. After 9 billion years of such enrichment, in an undistinguished part of the universe, the outskirts of the Virgo supercluster, in an undistinguished galaxy, the Milky Way, in an undistinguished region, the Orion Arm, an undistinguished star, the sun, was born. The gas cloud from which the sun formed contained a sufficient supply of heavy elements to coalesce and spawn a complex inventory of orbiting objects that includes several rocky and gaseous planets, hundreds of thousands of asteroids, and billions of comets. For the first several 100 million years, large quantities of leftover debris in wayward orbits would accrete onto larger bodies. This occurred in the form of high-speed, high-energy impacts, which rendered molten the surfaces of the rocky planets, preventing the formation of complex molecules. As less and less accretable matter remained in the solar system, planet surfaces began to cool. The one we call Earth formed in a kind of Goldilocks zone around the sun, where oceans remain largely in liquid form. Had Earth been much closer to the sun, the oceans would have evaporated. Had Earth been much farther away, the oceans would have frozen. In either case, life as we know it would not have evolved. Within the chemically rich liquid oceans, by a mechanism yet to be discovered, organic molecules transitioned to self-replicating life. Dominant in this primordial soup were simple anaerobic bacteria, life that thrives in oxygen-empty environments, but excretes chemically potent oxygen as one of its byproducts. These early single-celled organisms unwittingly transformed Earth's carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere into one with sufficient oxygen to allow aerobic organisms to emerge and dominate the oceans and land. These same oxygen atoms, normally found in pairs, O2, also combined in threes to form ozone, O3, in the upper atmosphere, which serves as a shield that protects Earth's surface from most of the sun's molecule-hostile ultraviolet photons. We owe the remarkable diversity of life on Earth, and we presume elsewhere in the universe, to the cosmic abundance of carbon and the countless number of simple and complex molecules that contain it. There is no doubt about it, more varieties of carbon-based molecules exist than all other kinds of molecules combined. But life is fragile. Earth's occasional encounters with large, wayward comets and asteroids, a formerly common event, wreaks intermittent havoc upon our ecosystem. A mere 65 million years ago, less than 2% of Earth's past, a 10-trillion-ton asteroid hit what is now the Yucatan Peninsula and obliterated more than 70% of Earth's flora and fauna, including all the famous outsized dinosaurs. Extinction. This ecological catastrophe enabled our mammal ancestors to fill freshly vacant niches rather than continue to serve as hors d'oeuvres for T-Rex. One big-brained branch of these mammals, that which we call primates, evolved a genus and species, Homo sapiens, with sufficient intelligence to invent methods and tools of science and to deduce the origin and evolution of the universe. What happened before all this? What happened before the beginning? Astrophysicists have no idea, or rather, our most creative ideas have little or no grounding in experimental science. In response, Some religious people assert, with a tinge of righteousness, that something must have started it all, a force greater than all others, a source from which everything issues, a prime mover. In the mind of such a person, that something is, of course, God. But what if the universe was always there, in a state or condition we have yet to identify? A multiverse, for instance, that continually births universes. Or what if the universe just popped into existence from nothing? Or what if everything we know and love were just a computer simulation rendered for entertainment by a superintelligent alien species? These philosophically fun ideas usually satisfy nobody. Nonetheless, they remind us that ignorance is the natural state of mind for a research scientist. People who believe they are ignorant of nothing have neither looked for nor stumbled upon the boundary between what is known and unknown in the universe. What we do know, and what we can assert without further hesitation, is that the universe had a beginning. The universe continues to evolve. And yes, every one of our body's atoms is traceable to the Big Bang and to the thermonuclear furnaces within high-mass stars that exploded more than 5 billion years ago. We are stardust brought to life, then empowered by the universe to figure itself out. And we have only just begun. Chapter 2. On Earth, as in the Heavens. Until Sir Isaac Newton wrote down the universal law of gravitation, nobody had any reason to presume that the laws of physics at home were the same everywhere else in the universe. Earth had earthly things going on, and heavens had heavenly things going on. According to Christian teachings of the day, God controlled the heavens, rendering them unknowable to our feeble mortal minds. When Newton breached this philosophical barrier by rendering all motion comprehensible and predictable, some theologians criticized him for leaving nothing for the Creator to do. Newton had figured out that the force of gravity pulling ripe apples from their orchards also guides tossed objects along their curved trajectories and directs the moon in its orbit around Earth. Newton's law of gravity also guides planets, asteroids, and comets in their orbits around the sun and keeps hundreds of billions of stars in orbit within our Milky Way galaxy. This universality of physical laws drives scientific discovery like nothing else. And gravity was just the beginning. Imagine the excitement among 19th century astronomers when laboratory prisms, which break light beams into a spectrum of colors, were first turned to the sun. Spectra are not only beautiful, but contain oodles of information about the light-emitting object, including its temperature and composition. Chemical elements reveal themselves by their unique patterns of light or dark bands that cut across the spectrum. To people's delight and amazement, the chemical signatures on the sun were identical to those in the laboratory. No longer the exclusive tool of chemists, the prism showed that as different as the sun is from Earth in size, mass, temperature, location, and appearance, we both contain the same stuff. Hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, calcium, iron, and so forth. But more important than our laundry list of shared ingredients was the recognition that the laws of physics prescribing the formation of these spectral signatures on the sun were the same laws operating on Earth, 93 million miles away. So fertile was this concept of universality that it was successfully applied in reverse. Further analysis of the sun's spectrum revealed the signature of an element that had no known counterpart on Earth. Being of the sun, the new substance was given a name derived from the Greek word helios, the sun, and was only later discovered in the lab. Thus, helium became the first and only element in the chemist's periodic table to be discovered someplace other than Earth. Okay, the laws of physics work in the solar system, but do they work across the galaxy, across the universe, across time itself? Step by step, the laws were tested. Nearby stars also revealed familiar chemicals. Distant binary stars, bound in mutual orbit, seem to know all about Newton's laws of gravity. For the same reason, so do binary galaxies. And, like the geologists' stratified sediments, which serve as a timeline of earthly events, the farther away we look in space, the further back in time we see. Spectra from the most distant objects in the universe show the same chemical signatures that we see nearby in space and in time. True, heavy elements were less abundant back then. They are manufactured primarily in subsequent generations of exploding stars. But the laws describing the atomic and molecular processes that created these spectral signatures remain intact. In particular, a quantity known as the fine structure constant, which controls the basic fingerprinting for every element, must have remained unchanged for billions of years. Of course, not all things and phenomena in the cosmos have counterparts on Earth. You've probably never walked through a cloud of glowing million-degree plasma, and I bet you've never greeted a black hole on the street. What matters is the universality of the physical laws that describe them. When spectral analysis was first applied to the light emitted by interstellar nebulae, a signature was discovered that, once again, had no counterpart on Earth. At the time, the periodic table of elements had no obvious place for a new element to fit. In response, astrophysicists invented the name nebulium as a placeholder until they could figure out what was going on. Turned out that in space, gaseous nebulae are so rarefied that atoms go long stretches without colliding. Under these conditions, electrons can do things within atoms that had never before been seen in Earth labs. Nebulium was simply the signature of ordinary oxygen doing extraordinary things. This universality of physical laws tells us that if we land on another planet with a thriving alien civilization, they will be running on the same laws that we have discovered and tested here on Earth, even if the aliens harbor different social and political beliefs. Furthermore, if you want to talk to the aliens, you can bet they don't speak English or French or even Mandarin. Nor would you know whether shaking their hands, if indeed their outstretched appendage is a hand, would be considered an act of war or peace. Your best hope is to find a way to communicate using the language of science. Such an attempt was made in the 1970s with Pioneer 10 and 11 and Voyager 1 and 2. All four spacecraft were endowed with enough energy after gravity assist from the giant planets to escape the solar system entirely. Pioneer wore a golden etched plaque that showed in scientific pictograms the layout of our solar system, our location in the Milky Way galaxy, and the structure of the hydrogen atom. Voyager went further and also included a gold record album containing diverse sounds from Mother Earth, including the human heartbeat, whale songs, and musical selections from around the world, including the works of Beethoven and Chuck Berry. While this humanized the message, it's not clear whether alien ears would have a clue what they were listening to, assuming they have ears in the first place. My favorite parody of this gesture was a skit on NBC's Saturday Night Live, shortly after the Voyager launch, in which they showed a written reply from the aliens who recovered the spacecraft. The note simply requested, "Send more Chuck Berry." Science thrives not only on the universality of physical laws, but also on the existence and persistence of physical constants. The constant of gravitation, known by most scientists as Big G, supplies Newton's equation of gravity with the measure of how strong the force will be. This quantity has been implicitly tested for variation over eons. If you do the math, you can determine that a star's luminosity is steeply dependent on Big G. In other words, if Big G had been even slightly different in the past, then the energy output of the sun would have been far more variable than anything the biological, climatological, or geological records indicate. Such is the uniformity of our universe. Among all constants, the speed of light is the most famous. No matter how fast you go, you will never overtake a beam of light. Why not? No experiment ever conducted has ever revealed an object of any form reaching the speed of light. Well-tested laws of physics predict and account for that fact. I know these statements sound close-minded. Some of the most boneheaded, science-based proclamations in the past have underestimated the ingenuity of inventors and engineers. We will never fly. Flying will never be commercially feasible. We will never split the atom. We will never break the sound barrier. We will never go to the moon. What they have in common is that no established law of physics stood in their way. The claim we will never outrun a beam of light is a qualitatively different prediction. It flows from basic, time-tested physical principles. Highway signs for interstellar travelers of the future will justifiably read, "The speed of light. It's not just a good idea. It's the law." Unlike getting caught speeding on Earth roads, the good thing about the laws of physics is that they require no law enforcement agencies to maintain them. Although, I did once own a geeky t-shirt that proclaimed, "Obey gravity." All measurements suggest that the known fundamental constants and the physical laws that reference them are neither time-dependent nor location-dependent. They're truly constant and universal. Many natural phenomena manifest multiple physical laws operating at once. This fact often complicates the analysis, and in most cases requires high-performance computing to calculate what's going on and to keep track of important parameters. When comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 plunged into Jupiter's gas-rich atmosphere in July 1994 and then exploded, the most accurate computer model combined the laws of fluid mechanics, thermodynamics, kinematics, and gravitation. Climate and weather represent other leading examples of complicated and difficult-to-predict phenomena, but the basic laws governing them are still at work. Jupiter's Great Red Spot, a raging anticyclone that's been going strong for at least 350 years, is driven by identical physical processes that generate storms on Earth and elsewhere in the solar system. Another class of universal truths is the conservation laws, where the amount of some measured quantity remains unchanged no matter what. The three most important are the conservation of mass and energy, conservation of linear and angular momentum, and the conservation of electric charge. These laws are in evidence on Earth and everywhere we have thought to look, from the domain of particle physics to the large-scale structure of the universe. In spite of this boasting, all is not perfect in paradise. It happens that we cannot see, touch, or taste the source of 85% of the gravity we measure in the universe. This mysterious dark matter, which remains undetected except for its gravitational pull on matter we see, may be composed of exotic particles that we have yet to discover or identify. A small minority of astrophysicists, however, are unconvinced and have suggested that there is no dark matter. You just need to modify Newton's law of gravity. Simply add a few components to the equations, and all will be well. Perhaps one day we will learn that Newton's gravity indeed requires adjustment. That'll be okay. It has happened once before. Einstein's 1916 general theory of relativity expanded on the principles of Newton's gravity in a way that also applied to objects of extremely high mass. Newton's law of gravity breaks down in this expanded realm, which was unknown to him. The lesson here is that our confidence flows through the range of conditions over which a law has been tested and verified. The broader that range, the more potent and powerful the law becomes in describing the cosmos. For ordinary household gravity, Newton's law works just fine. It got us to the moon and returned us safely to Earth in 1969. For black holes and the large-scale structure of the universe, we need general relativity. And if you insert low mass and low speeds into Einstein's equations, they literally, or rather mathematically, become Newton's equations. All good reasons to develop confidence in our understanding and of all we claim to understand. To the scientist, the universality of physical laws makes the cosmos a marvelously simple place. By comparison, human nature, the psychologist's domain, is infinitely more daunting. In America, local school boards vote on subjects to be taught in the classroom. In some cases, votes are cast according to the whims of cultural, political, or religious tides. Around the world, varying belief systems lead to political differences that are not always resolved peacefully. The power and beauty of physical laws is that they apply everywhere, whether or not you choose to believe in them. In other words, after the laws of physics, everything else is opinion. Not that scientists don't argue. We do, a lot. But when we do, we typically express opinions about the interpretation of insufficient or ratty data on the bleeding frontier of our knowledge. Wherever and whenever a physical law can be invoked in the discussion, the debate is guaranteed to be brief. No, your idea for a perpetual motion machine will never work. It violates well-tested laws of thermodynamics. No, you can't build a time machine that will enable you to go back and kill your mother before you were born. It violates causality laws. And without violating momentum laws, you cannot spontaneously levitate and hover above the ground, whether or not you are seated in the lotus position. You could, in principle, perform this stunt if you managed to let forth a powerful and sustained exhaust of flatulence. Knowledge of physical laws can, in some cases, give you the confidence to confront surly people. A few years ago, I was having a hot cocoa nightcap at a dessert shop in Pasadena, California. Ordered it with whipped cream, of course. When it arrived at the table, I saw no trace of the stuff. After I told the waiter that my cocoa had no whipped cream, he asserted I couldn't see it because it sank to the bottom. But whipped cream has low density and floats on all liquids that humans consume. So I offered the waiter two possible explanations. Either somebody forgot to add the whipped cream to my hot cocoa, or the universal laws of physics were different in his restaurant. Unconvinced, he defiantly brought over a dollop of whipped cream to demonstrate his claim. After bobbing once or twice, the whipped cream rose to the top, safely afloat. What better proof do you need of the universality of physical law? Chapter 3. Let There Be Light. After the Big Bang, the main agenda of the cosmos was expansion, ever diluting the concentration of energy that filled space. With each passing moment, the universe got a little bit bigger, a little bit cooler, and a little bit dimmer. Meanwhile, matter and energy co-inhabited a kind of opaque soup in which free-range electrons continually scattered photons every which way. For 380,000 years, things carried on that way. In this early epoch, photons didn't travel far before encountering an electron. Back then, if your mission had been to see across the universe, you couldn't. Any photon you detected had careened off an electron right in front of your nose, nano and picoseconds earlier. A billionth and a trillionth of a second. Since that's the largest distance that information can travel before reaching your eyes, the entire universe was simply a glowing, opaque fog in every direction you looked. The sun and all other stars behave this way, too. As the temperature drops, particles move more and more slowly. And so, right about then, when the temperature of the universe first dipped below a red-hot 3,000 degrees Kelvin, electrons slowed down just enough to be captured by passing protons, thus bringing full-fledged atoms into the world. This allowed previously harassed photons to be set free and travel on uninterrupted paths across the universe. This cosmic background is the incarnation of the leftover light from a dazzling, sizzling early universe, and can be assigned a temperature based on what part of the spectrum the dominant photons represent. As the cosmos continued to cool, the photons that had been born in the visible part of the spectrum lost energy to the expanding universe, and eventually slid down the spectrum, morphing into infrared photons. Although the visible light photons had become weaker and weaker, they never stopped being photons. What's next on the spectrum? Today, the universe has expanded by a factor of 1,000 from the time photons were set free. And so, the cosmic background has in turn cooled by a factor of 1,000. All the visible light photons from that epoch have become 1/1,000th as energetic. They're now microwaves, which is where we derive the modern moniker Cosmic Microwave Background, or CMB for short. Keep this up, and 50 billion years from now, astrophysicists will be writing about the cosmic radio wave background. When something glows from being heated, it emits light in all parts of the spectrum, but will always peak somewhere. For household lamps that still use glowing metal filaments, the bulbs all peak in the infrared, which is the single greatest contributor to their inefficiency as a source of visible light. Our senses detect infrared only in the form of warmth on our skin. The LED revolution in advanced lighting technology creates pure visible light without wasting wattage on invisible parts of the spectrum. That's how you can get crazy-sounding sentences on packaging, like 7 watts LED replaces 60 watts incandescent. Being the remnant of something that was once brilliantly aglow, the CMB has the profile we expect of a radiant but cooling object. It peaks in one part of the spectrum, but radiates in other parts of the spectrum as well. In this case, besides peaking in microwaves, the CMB also gives off some radio waves and a vanishingly small number of photons of higher energy. In the mid-20th century, the subfield of cosmology, not to be confused with cosmetology, didn't have much data, and where data are sparse, competing ideas abound that are clever and wishful. The existence of the CMB was predicted by the Russian-born American physicist George Gamow and colleagues during the 1940s. The foundation of these ideas came from the 1927 work of the Belgian physicist and priest Georges Lemaître, who is generally recognized as the father of Big Bang cosmology. But it was American physicists Ralph Alpher and Robert Hermann who, in 1948, first estimated what the temperature of the cosmic background ought to be. They based their calculations on three pillars. 1. Einstein's 1916 general theory of relativity. 2. Edwin Hubble's 1929 discovery that the universe is expanding. And 3. Atomic physics developed in laboratories before and during the Manhattan Project that built the atomic bombs of World War II. Hermann and Alpher calculated and proposed a temperature of 5 degrees Kelvin for the universe. Well, that's just plain wrong. The precisely measured temperature of these microwaves is 2.725 degrees, sometimes written as simply 2.7 degrees. And if you're numerically lazy, nobody will fault you for rounding the temperature of the universe to 3 degrees. Let's pause for a moment. Hermann and Alpher used atomic physics, freshly gleaned in a lab, and applied it to hypothesized conditions in the early universe. From this, they extrapolated billions of years forward, calculating what temperature the universe should be today. That their prediction even remotely approximated the right answer is a stunning triumph of human insight. They could have been off by a factor of 10 or 100, or they could have predicted something that isn't even there. Commenting on this feat, the American astrophysicist J. Richard Gott noted, "Predicting that the background existed and then getting its temperature correct to within a factor of 2 was like predicting that a flying saucer 50 feet wide would land on the White House lawn, but instead, a flying saucer 27 feet wide actually showed up." The first direct observation of the cosmic microwave background was made inadvertently in 1964, by American physicists Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson of Bell Telephone Laboratories, the research branch of AT&T. In the 1960s, everyone knew about microwaves, but almost no one had the technology to detect them. Bell Labs, a pioneer in the communications industry, developed a beefy horn-shaped antenna for just that purpose. But first, if you're going to send or receive a signal, you don't want too many sources contaminating it. Penzias and Wilson sought to measure background microwave interference to their receiver to enable clean, noise-free communication within this band of the spectrum. They were not cosmologists. They were techno-wizards honing a microwave receiver and unaware of the Gamow, Hermann, and Alpher predictions. What Penzias and Wilson were decidedly not looking for was the cosmic microwave background. They were just trying to open a new channel of communication for AT&T. Penzias and Wilson ran their experiment and subtracted from their data all the known terrestrial and cosmic sources of interference they could identify. But one part of the signal didn't go away, and they just couldn't figure out how to eliminate it. Finally, they looked inside their antenna and saw pigeons nesting there. They were worried that a white dielectric substance, pigeon poop, might be responsible for the signal, because they detected it no matter what direction the detector pointed. After cleaning out the dielectric substance, the interference dropped a little bit, but a leftover signal remained. The paper they published in 1965 was all about this unaccountable excess antenna temperature. Meanwhile, a team of physicists at Princeton, led by Robert Dickey, was building a detector specifically to find the CMB. but they didn't have the resources of Bell Labs, so their work went a little slower. And the moment Dickey and his colleagues heard about Penzias and Wilson's work, the Princeton team knew exactly what the observed excess antenna temperature was. Everything fit, especially the temperature itself, and that the signal came from every direction in the sky. In 1978, Penzias and Wilson won the Nobel Prize for their discovery. And in 2006, American astrophysicists John C. Mather and George F. Smoot would share the Nobel Prize for observing the CMB over a broad range of the spectrum, bringing cosmology from a nursery of clever but untested ideas into the realm of a precision experimental science. Because light takes time to reach us from distant places in the universe, if we look out in deep space, we actually see eons back in time. So if the intelligent inhabitants of a galaxy far, far away were to measure the temperature of the cosmic background radiation at the moment captured by our gaze, they should get a reading higher than 2.7 degrees, because they are living in a younger, smaller, hotter universe than we are. Turns out you can actually test this hypothesis. The molecule cyanogen, CN, once used on convicted murderers as the active component of the gas administered by their executioners, gets excited by exposure to microwaves. If the microwaves are warmer than the ones in our CMB, they excite the molecule a little more. In the Big Bang model, the cyanogen in distant younger galaxies gets bathed in a warmer cosmic background than the cyanogen in our own Milky Way galaxy. And that's exactly what we observe. You can't make this stuff up. Why should any of this be interesting? The universe was opaque until 380,000 years after the Big Bang, so you could not have witnessed matter taking shape, even if you'd been sitting front row center. You couldn't have seen where the galaxy clusters and voids were starting to form. Before anybody could have seen anything worth seeing, photons had to travel unimpeded across the universe as carriers of this information. The spot where each photon began its cross-cosmos journey is where it had smacked into the last electron that would ever stand in its way, the point of last scatter. As more and more photons escape unsmacked, they create an expanding surface of last scatter, some 120,000 years deep. That surface is where all the atoms in the universe were born. An electron joins an atomic nucleus, and a little pulse of energy in the form of a photon soars away into the wild red yonder. By then, some regions of the universe had already begun to coalesce by the gravitational attraction of their parts. Photons that last scattered off electrons in these regions developed a different, slightly cooler profile than those scattering off the less sociable electrons sitting in the middle of nowhere. Where matter accumulated, the strength of gravity grew, enabling more and more matter to gather. These regions seeded the formation of galaxy superclusters, while other regions were left relatively empty. When you map the cosmic microwave background in detail, you find that it's not completely smooth. It's got spots that are slightly hotter and slightly cooler than average. By studying these temperature variations in the CMB, that is to say, by studying patterns in the surface of last scatter, we can infer what the structure and content of the matter was in the early universe. To figure out how galaxies and clusters and superclusters arose, we use our best probe, the CMB, a potent time capsule that empowers astrophysicists to reconstruct cosmic history in reverse. Studying its patterns is like performing some sort of cosmic phrenology as we analyze the skull bumps of the infant universe. When constrained by other observations of the contemporary and distant universe, the CMB enables you to decode all sorts of fundamental cosmic properties. Compare the distribution of sizes and temperatures of the warm and cool areas, and you can infer how strong the force of gravity was at the time, and how quickly matter accumulated, allowing you to then deduce how much ordinary matter, and dark energy there is in the universe. From here, it's then straightforward to tell whether or not the universe will expand forever. Ordinary matter is what we're all made of. It has gravity and interacts with light. Dark matter is a mysterious substance that has gravity but does not interact with light in any known way. Dark energy is a mysterious pressure in the vacuum of space that acts in the opposite direction of gravity, forcing the universe to expand faster than it otherwise would. What our phrenological exam says is that we understand how the universe behaved, but that most of the universe is made of stuff about which we are clueless. Our profound areas of ignorance notwithstanding, today as never before, cosmology has an anchor, because the CMB reveals the portal through which we all walked. It's a point where interesting physics happened, and where we learned about the universe before and after its light was set free. The simple discovery of the cosmic microwave background turned cosmology into something more than mythology. But it was the accurate and detailed map of the cosmic microwave background that turned cosmology into a modern science. Cosmologists have plenty of ego. How could you not when your job is to deduce what brought the universe into existence? Without data, their explanations were just hypotheses. Now, each new observation, each morsel of data, wields a two-edged sword. It enables cosmology to thrive on the kind of foundation that so much of the rest of science enjoys. But it also constrains theories that people thought up when there wasn't enough data to say whether they were right or wrong. No science achieves maturity without it. Chapter 4. Between the Galaxies. In the grand tally of cosmic constituents, galaxies are what typically get counted. Latest estimates show that the observable universe may contain 100 billion of them. Bright and beautiful and packed with stars, galaxies decorate the dark voids of space like cities across a country at night. But just how voidy is the void of space? How empty is the countryside between cities? Just because galaxies are in your face, and just because they would have us believe that nothing else matters, the universe may nonetheless contain hard-to-detect things between the galaxies. Maybe those things are more interesting or more important to the evolution of the universe than the galaxies themselves. Our own spiral-shaped galaxy, the Milky Way, is named for its spilled milk appearance to the unaided eye across Earth's nighttime sky. Indeed, the very word galaxy derives from the Greek galaxias, milky. Our pair of nearest neighbor galaxies, 600,000 light-years distant, are both small and irregularly shaped. Ferdinand Magellan's ship's log identified these cosmic objects during his famous round-the-world voyage of 1519. In his honor, we call them the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds, and they're visible primarily from the southern hemisphere as a pair of cloud-like splotches on the sky, parked beyond the stars. The nearest galaxy, larger than our own, is 2 million light-years away beyond the stars that trace the constellation Andromeda. This spiral galaxy, historically dubbed the Great Nebula in Andromeda, is a somewhat more massive and luminous twin of the Milky Way. Notice that the name for each system lacks reference to the existence of stars. Milky Way, Magellanic Clouds, Andromeda Nebulae. All three were named before telescopes were invented, so they could not yet be resolved into their stellar constituencies. As detailed in Chapter 9, without the benefit of telescopes operating in multiple bands of light, we might still declare the space between the galaxies to be empty. Aided by modern detectors and modern theories, we have probed our cosmic countryside and revealed all manner of hard-to-detect things. Dwarf galaxies, runaway stars that explode, million-degree X-ray-emitting gas, dark matter, faint blue galaxies, ubiquitous gas clouds, super-duper high-energy charged particles, and the mysterious quantum vacuum energy. With a list like that, one could argue that all the fun in the universe happens between the galaxies rather than within them. In any reliably surveyed volume of space, dwarf galaxies outnumber large galaxies by more than 10 to 1. The first essay I ever wrote on the universe in the early 1980s was titled The Galaxy and the Seven Dwarfs, referring to the Milky Way's diminutive nearby family. Since then, the tally of local dwarf galaxies has been counted in the dozens. While full-blooded galaxies contain hundreds of billions of stars, dwarf galaxies can have as few as a million, which renders them 100,000 times harder to detect. No wonder they're still being discovered in front of our noses. Images of dwarf galaxies that no longer manufacture stars tend to look like tiny, boring smudges. Those dwarfs that do form stars are all irregularly shaped and, quite frankly, are a sorry-looking lot. Dwarf galaxies have three things working against their detection. They're small, and so they're easily passed over when seductive spiral galaxies vie for your attention. They're dim, and so are missed in many surveys of galaxies that cut off below a pre-specified brightness level. And they have low density of stars within them, so they offer poor contrast above the glow of surrounding light from Earth's nighttime atmosphere and from other sources. All this is true, but since dwarfs far outnumber normal galaxies, perhaps our definition of what is normal needs revision. You will find most known dwarf galaxies hanging out near bigger galaxies, in orbit around them like satellites. The two Magellanic Clouds are part of the Milky Way's dwarf family. But the lives of satellite galaxies can be quite hazardous. Most computer models of their orbits show a slow decay that ultimately results in the hapless dwarfs getting ripped apart and then eaten by the main galaxy. The Milky Way engaged in at least one act of cannibalism in the last billion years, when it consumed a dwarf galaxy whose flayed remains can be seen as a stream of stars orbiting the galactic center beyond the stars of the constellation Sagittarius. The system is called the Sagittarius Dwarf, but should probably have been named Lunch. In the high-density environment of clusters, two or more large galaxies routinely collide and leave behind a titanic mess, spiral structures warped beyond all recognition, newly induced bursts of star-forming regions spawned from the violent collisions of gas clouds, and hundreds of millions of stars strewn hither and yon, having freshly escaped the gravity of both galaxies. Some stars reassemble to form blobs that could be called dwarf galaxies. Other stars remain adrift. About 10% of all large galaxies show evidence of a major gravitational encounter with another large galaxy, and that rate may be 5 times higher among galaxies and clusters. With all this mayhem, how much galactic flotsam permeates intergalactic space, especially within clusters? Nobody knows for sure. The measurement is difficult because isolated stars are too dim to detect individually. We must rely on detecting a faint glow produced by the light of all stars combined. In fact, observations of clusters detect just such a glow between the galaxies, suggesting that there may be as many vagabond homeless stars as there are stars within the galaxies themselves. Adding ammo to the discussion, we have found, without looking for them, more than a dozen supernovas that exploded far away from what we presume to be their host galaxies. In ordinary galaxies, for every star that explodes in this way, 100,000 to a million do not. So isolated supernovas may betray entire populations of undetected stars. Supernovas are stars that have blown themselves to smithereens and, in the process, have temporarily over several weeks increased their luminosity a billionfold, making them visible across the universe. While a dozen homeless supernovas is a relatively small number, many more may await discovery, since most supernova searches systematically monitor known galaxies and not empty space. There's more to clusters than their constituent galaxies and their wayward stars. Measurements made with X-ray-sensitive telescopes reveal a space-filling intracluster gas at tens of millions of degrees. The gas is so hot that it glows strongly in the X-ray part of the spectrum. The very movement of gas-rich galaxies through this medium eventually strips them of their own gas, forcing them to forfeit their capacity to make new stars. That could explain it, but when you calculate the total mass present in this heated gas, for most clusters, it exceeds the mass of all galaxies in the cluster by as much as a factor of 10. Worse yet, clusters are overrun by dark matter, which happens to contain up to another factor of 10 times the mass of everything else. In other words, if telescopes observed mass rather than light, then our cherished galaxies and clusters would appear as insignificant blips amid a giant spherical blob of gravitational forces. In the rest of space, outside of clusters, there's a population of galaxies that thrived long ago. As already noted, Looking out into the cosmos is analogous to a geologist looking across sedimentary strata, where the history of rock formation is laid out in full view. Cosmic distances are so vast that the travel time for light to reach us can be millions or even billions of years.